drive the truck that has the two elephants. And I get on the lot and I help do everything. April the 22nd, we opened this year. And like I say, made our tour from the Carolinas. We opened to Florida and come up to Carolinas where we keep the trucks in winter quarters. These big tobacco warehouses where the Newports come from and so forth. And then we opened there and rebuilt inside. You see, and we went as clear as the Canadian border in northern Maine, corrupt Fort Kent, Matapiska, which is the extreme northern boundary there. And then we come on back and usually close and put in the same warehouse again. We're only going to be till 5th of October. My man's having trouble in the south, a lot of integration trouble down there. They're afraid some of the towns don't want to book you because they say, well, it's going to create a little heat. So we thought, well, he said, it's a little difficult to book, so we'll close October the 5th this year. Ordinarily, go about another week, about 13, about 26 weeks, something like that's the usual season for us.
Walt Davis, Roger's brother-in-law, head hustler, chief mechanic, boss canvasman.
I get up around 4:30, quarter to 5. But I don't know, for some reason or other, sleep never bothered me. Even when I'm home, I'm up at 6. And there's nothing for me to do.
I gotta keep busy. I gotta keep my hands busy, otherwise I'm fidgety.
I gotta do something. I just can't lay around. I gotta say, I can't stand still. Now, whether the boss canvasman or the superintendent, they'll just stand and push them, but I can't do it. I gotta keep doing with it, because I just can't stand still. I just get nervous and fidgety. If I'm moving around, I can relax better than I can by standing around and watching them. In other words, I see them, and I see them just things that it just gets on my nerves. I finally have to just jump in and do it anyhow, so I just work along with them, and it relaxes me, and it makes the office go better, and it makes the men feel better that, well, the boss is working along with us, so we move along pretty good. In other words, most of the shows right about this size would take around about 4 hours to put it up. We generally put it up about 2.5-3 hours. But it's a system that we've got that worked out where everybody is automatically, after a man been over here 2 or 3 days, I lay out a certain sort of schedule for him that he falls into that pattern and it keeps moving around. Where most shows, they have a turmoil. The first thing he's doing one thing, the next day he's doing another thing. Where the men, they don't know what the hell they're going to do. See, well, here, they automatically know what they're going to do and it just falls in and it's just a pattern that I picked up years ago that you just keep, like horses, and anything is like horses. It's just a routine, it's over and over, it's what you call training.
The workers get $25 to $35 a week, their food, and a place to sleep.
And they weed themselves out as they can't take it. They weed themselves out. If they can survive it, then they stick with you. And, of course, the boys stay during the season, all season. They get a little bonus at the end of the season, too. Not too large. And we try, and those fellows that show the possibilities, we tip them, but we don't add it to their salary, because if you get a bad week, then you'd still have to give it to them. You know what I mean? We would pay these boys more because they deserve more. They're good, capable men. But you don't know if you got them today or you got them tomorrow. Now, we might go out there tonight and find 3 or 4 boys laid out. Laid out, flat drunk. And so they, we docked them for it. Well, they pay for it, but money doesn't mean anything. It's that they just want that. And they're awfully good boys. They are really good working men.
Well, if that part don't matter. You could give them $70. You still wouldn't get them to work right, regardless. Eh? They're just not going to do it. They're not that type. It isn't the money so much. It's just the people themselves that just don't give a damn about giving the man an honest day's work. Or say, well, the hell with it. Say, they don't give a damn.
They're just as good as you ask for to be with you, because they know everything to do. They put the whole thing up with themselves, and they'll do anything for you. But they just got a little weakness for wine. More than beer or whiskey, so wine they like. Cheaper, I guess.
There are many tented circuses traveling America. This one is different because in part of this man. He's Roger's nephew, a wire walker named Harold Barnes. He was once a great circus star.
Yes, I'd had a good long, hard career of it, and my last season out was with a series of Shrine-sponsored circuses. And I figured, well, I was on top then, I thought I'd do like Gene Tooney did, quit while I was ahead. So I wasn't married at that time. I had a nice little bankroll. And I went to the University of Miami. So my uncle had a disappointment with an act, and they disappointed him without notice. And he had these contracts, and he had to open, and he called me on the telephone, asked if I would come up for a week just to get the show organized.
So I phoned down to Harold and said, Harold, can you come up and help us? I had feelers out for some other acts. Can you come and help us for a week or two? Well, that week or two has now blossomed into 6 or 7 or 8 years.
Well, I was a child prodigy. I did somersaults on the wire when I was 11 years old. And when I was 12 years old, I was featured with Clyde Beatty with some of the major railroad circuses throughout the country. And I've made many appearances in Europe. The Billboard publication, the theatrical publication, Our Bible, had a series of contests one time, all the performers and managers in the country voting on their top performers. And they voted me as the top wire walker and the fifth top performer in the country. The fifth top performer of all branches and the top wire walker.
50 for kids, $1 for adults. We charge a quarter for the individual chairs. Bleachers, got plenty of free bleachers, and they're just as close to the tent as you notice, but there's more comfort in the elevated platform on a chair, naturally. And we can't afford to carry those without getting a little something out of them, so we charge. We have got as high as 40, but the season's been a little off, been charging a quarter.
We'll come out all right.
Now, like I say, the first real losing week we had was last week, where we actually had to take some out of the kitty to take care of the performance. But until this week, it's been the only loser.
Well, I do the minor mechanical work, like clutches and tune-up jobs, you know, and a little minor work. Any big jobs, like motors, where we have to pull a motor out, well, we turn out to a garage. But like a clutch or something I can repair right on the lot, I can do that. I do that right on the lot, see. Like brake trouble, I pull the brakes and put the lining in them, and master cylinders, stuff like that, I do that, too, see. Naturally, we wanted to move the next morning, so the only thing left to do is for me to get in there and do it, see, so... I generally get started maybe right after then, and I get in and clean up and work the horse, and then right after the horse, I jump on and finish it up and have it running by the night, see? Because I work a little fast in the ordinary wood in the regular garage, you know, because I know it's got to be done, so I just work fast and do it.
Every day, they put the tent up, and every day, they take it down. Every day, two performances, and every day, a new lot, a new town. Except for the roustabouts and for two Latin American couples, Los Argentinos from Argentina and Los Arias from Cuba, the Beers Barn Circus is family.
We have one little girl, 5 years old, just turned 5 this year. My wife represents the fourth generation in show business, and I've known my wife's family, I guess, longer in circus business than any other family. She doesn't juggle in the show. But her family, we're jugglers, and she is one of the finest girl jugglers in the country. She can put up 5 very easily, and she can juggle 4 clubs, and 4 clubs for a woman is very hard because her hands are small. It's hard to wrap around the clubs. I don't practice now as much as I used to when I was in the competitive field. I used to practice many, many hours a day, but now I'm rather lax. I don't, because my work is too long.
This is where you see all the...
When I pull in, I have several units to spot and place, and... My mother runs the concession on the show, the concession trailer. So I'll spot her trailer, unload her, and get the concessions ready, and bring in the snake show, or that we have, they call it a pit show. It's an extra little side show. It's not the big side show, but it's a little extra side show. I'll take care of that show, set it up, put the banner line, the advertising, the microphone, and take care of the animals, water them, feed them, then do buying for the concession stand, which includes buying the ice, soft drinks, water from supply houses, the cups and straws and dispensers, the things used in the dispensing of the soft drinks on the circus. Then I go into the big top and set my wife's apparatus, my apparatus. By that time, it's ready to get ready for the opening of the front door, not the circus, but the front door, the midwing. And I will dress and go on the sideshow, where I sell tickets in the valley, or spiel, as they say, over the sideshow. 5 minutes before the show starts, I'll close it up, run in, get ready, and I'm the first act on the show.
And then when it comes time to open the doors, I get on the ticket box and I sell the ticket. That's the only time I get to handle the money. And I have turned over to my partner, see, and he has the rest of the worry about it. But I do get to feel it first. Charlie Beers and I are equal partners. But he takes care of the bookwork. I take care of anything otherwise that he won't do. In other words, he likes to have the money, and, well, he can't see as well. But now we're at the present, we got him doing labor, too, because these two drivers have left, and he's putting up this little animal annex in one of my actors, which they're not supposed to do anything out here. In 1908, we started in what's called a family key circuit. And we were doing some vaudeville down in Virginia. And we happened to run across a fellow that asked us. Our bookings during the summer, a lot of those theaters didn't operate. So they asked us, would we like to go out on a tent show? That was in 1912. And my dad said, well, sure, we've never been on a tent, but we had to do it. And what are you going to do? He said, well, we'll put on vaudeville. So we put on vaudeville, but it was different from our act. It was the, what you call the old-time after pieces. I was a singer in those days, that's right. Didn't ever realize, but I was. Tenor, by the way. A boy soprano, is that what they called it? Yeah, I was one of those things. But later on, then we got in doing all these old after pieces, and we went in the vaudeville business and got our own tent. How we got our own tent, the fellow couldn't pay us off. And he said, would we take the tent in lieu of salary, which we did.
And now to start, we present the Two Stooges on the Mounting Trail Police.
Joined us as the Five Musical Beers out of Rahway, New Jersey, where they lived in those days. And it was the mother, the father, and the three kids. So we've been together ever since 1918, until the older ones passed on, and we're still together now. Everything's been fine. I got no complaints of any kind. Just it's been fine. Everything's been fine. We fight, and we argue, and cuss each other out, but everything goes along just wonderful. Well, since 1918, you know, there's bound to be some flare-ups now and then, but it must be all right. We would stuck together that long.
All right, Papa Boy. And now I want you to wave goodbye to all these folks.
Wave goodbye to all the boys and girls, Bucky. Wave goodbye. Bucky, the sea lion.
And now to fly over the center ring in an exhibition of strength and agility, presenting the Ripple of Anna Cuba, Los Arias.
I can't continue this work all my life. As a matter of fact, I'm on the decline now, so to speak. Well, the audience doesn't realize it, but I do. One has a certain amount of coordination when you're younger, and when you get a little age on it, you can still do it. You still fool the audience. You still do your work, but it's a little harder for you. I'm 40.
Señor Arias will support the twirling body of his partner with his teeth while executing a perfect handstand. Watch him. presenting Harold Barr.
Very nerve-wracking. A wire act is very nerve-wracking. One never knows. Some sort of wire act is nerve-wracking, I'll say. Because one never knows whether you're going to stay on the wire or miss the trick. Any little thing can throw a person off. It can be just a mental attitude. I can be physically in line. The rigging can be perfect. My wire can be perfect. I can leave exactly the precise time, and my mind says I'm not ready to go, and I will miss the trick. Whereas, on the other hand, I can be very nervous at this day. The rigging could be not set properly, have a very loud, boisterous audience, and I can throw when I'm not set, but my mind says that I am set, and I will complete the somersault. It's mind over matter.
Harold Barnes' act here is leading to a special trick, a backward bounding somersault.
It's a very difficult type of somersault because you have several different points of balance in the completion of the trick. The first balance, which is of utmost importance, you have to be in perfect alignment when you start. When you drop down and sit on the wire, you have to be also in perfect alignment. Your somersault will have to do the proper turning at the proper time, straight up and down, perpendicular. And when you land again, you have to be in perfect alignment. And when you come to the feet, you can't always be in perfect alignment when you come to the feet, but you try, if possible, to maintain your equilibrium. You look at the wire only momentarily as you're turning upside down, and you try to adjust yourself and see whether you're shooting to the left or to the right. You try to align yourself accordingly. It's an involuntary process. You don't realize you're doing it, but you do do it. And one never looks at the wire before you land with your feet. You look at the end of the wire, knowing that if your head is straight over the wire, your feet will more than likely come down beneath your head. Many people are under the misapprehension that the performer looks down at the wire. You only spot the wire when you're upside down, and then you immediately turn your eyes away from the wire and sight the end, where you can maintain a better balance. You don't close your eyes. You actually react mechanically. After doing it so many times, your body can sense what you're doing, your mind and body together in coordination can sense what you're doing, rather. And that you, that they react mechanically. Many times I fall.
And now, from the land of the Gauchos in South America, in their daring perch display, we next present the Argentino.
People or whether the tent is packed, and I just put my all into it, and I'm kind of in heaven up there. I just feel it. It's just everything to me.
When I was first starting to do wire, my father and I went over to the circus, the Hunt Brothers Circus, where they were performing. Well, I've known the family all these many years, and they had this little blonde girl, did a very beautiful trapeze act, and I saw her grew up, and all of a sudden she blossomed out into a beauty, and I was knocked off the seats when I happened to walk into the circus and saw her. And I...
Jim, ever even. Arrivederci.
How'd it run?
Yeah, I ran all the 20 left, and the race was out of clutch.
Oh,
too hot setup.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. The paddle just went away and broke the line.
This is when you need something more than a soft drink. Nothing soft about the taste of Coca-Cola. It's unmistakable. Lifts your spirits, boosts your energy.
Things go better with Coca-Cola. Things go better with Coca-Cola.
For our parading astronauts. Peter Jennings.
American advisors have taken yet in the war in Vietnam.
The jets swoop high over Dong Doi and continue to batter at three regiments of Viet Cong dug in 5 miles from the town. At least three battalions of Vietnamese troops have been wiped out. The jungle around the outpost is littered with hundreds of bodies. Government troops, Viet Cong, women and children of Dong Doi who sought refuge under the trees. And at the landing zone, the flotsam of war.
They must have patience. They must wait. Huh? We have many people to take to hospital. As soon as we get more choppers, okay.
7th Vietnamese Airborne Battalion exists no more. This is the lone survivor. He threw his weapon and his uniform away and hid in the jungle. A relief force found him. He was being beaten when an American sergeant pulled him away and brought him back to Dong Doi. After further interrogation by a Vietnamese officer, he was put back in uniform and sent back to the thick of the fighting. Inside the compound, a few burnt-out shells left standing. There were 20 Americans here. In the initial attack, 17 were killed. The Viet Cong came in wave after wave, riddling everything with small arms fire. Then through the windows, flamethrowers and grenades. Now it's the command post for the continuing battle of Dong Doi. Fear, but mostly the smell of hundreds of dead, rotting bodies.
Fully destroyed. For over 24 hours, Dong Doi was bombarded. First by Viet Cong mortars, then by American and Vietnamese planes. There was little left of the village or the villagers. Everywhere there were bodies, Viet Cong, civilians, government soldiers, all mixed together. Then there were the living. This Vietnamese was the commander of the village defense force. He survived. An American, Navy Lieutenant Frank Pritterlin, escaped when his position was overrun. This girl lost her mother and father. Everyone lost someone or something. No one won at Dong Doi. The government lost several hundred men and an entire battalion. The Viet Cong lost hundreds of their best soldiers and had to abandon most of their weapons. Most of all, it was the people of Dong Doi who lost. Over 100 villages were killed by the Viet Cong mortars and American airstrikes. The final tragedy of Dong Doi is that after so many lives were lost fighting for it, no one wants it. The Viet Cong have withdrawn to prepare for their next attack. The government has decided to evacuate the villagers and resettle them. Dong Doi no longer exists. The pattern of the Vietnam War is now brutally clear. The Viet Cong and government are locked in a war of attrition in which casualties on both sides are suffering.
When we really saw the earth down below us, we were just a speck in the sky. Very insignificant. When we came back, the same thing was impressed upon me again. It was a large ocean. We were a small speck. But somehow, the people that were looking for us found us. And I think that this symbolized to me really what our space program should mean to me, and I think should mean to everyone else. It's a wonderful bit of cooperation between everyone in the United States, and it makes me very proud to be an American.
I saw Americans as I've always thought they were. It didn't make any difference if they were black or white or red. They were just Americans out there, and they were feeling like Americans, I almost felt like cheering myself. I don't know why.
The Negroes that White was so pleased to see along the route did nothing to interfere with the celebration.
And we have never had any intention to do anything while these two men were in town, because what they did was bigger than America. They represented the entire free world, the same type of world that we are trying to get in Chicago, a free city. And the reason we have been so secretive about what we've been planning on doing, the seed of disrupting a parade was planted by downtown City Hall. And had Mayor Daley known after he planted the seed that we had no intentions on disrupting the parade, I'm sure he would have sent some of those stupid idiot precinct captains of his into the project to get somebody downtown to do it. We'd like for Mayor Daley to know that those same police that he brought out for this so-called trick he had planned today, he better keep them ready for tomorrow.
General to replace local registrars with his own men in cases where the ban is not respected. Mississippi's Governor Paul Johnson calls the bill discriminatory, harsh, punitive, and unconstitutional. And in the South's first move to keep federal registrars from coming down here, he called a special session of the state legislature to revise Mississippi's voter requirements before the federal government comes in to do it for them. Johnson told legislators,
Mississippi as a sovereign state has the constitutional right to establish the voting qualifications of her people. Our state should insist on her right to continue to do so. We should never voluntarily surrender this prerogative to the federal government.
The position of a kind of Jeremiah. For example, I don't disagree with Mr. Burford that the inequality suffered by the American Negro population of the United States has hindered the American dream. Indeed, it has. I quarrel with some other things he has to say. The other deeper element of a certain awkwardness I feel has to do with it has to do with one's point of view. I have to put it that way. One's sense or one's system of reality. It would seem to me the proposition before the House, when I put it that way, is the American dream at the expense of the American Negro, or the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro, is a question hideously loaded, and that one's response to that question, one's reaction to that question, has to depend on effect on where you find yourself in the world, what your sense of reality is, what your system of reality is. That is, it depends on assumptions which we hold so deeply as to be scarcely aware of them. A white South African, or a Mississippi sharecropper, or a Mississippi sheriff, or a Frenchman driven out of Algeria, all have, at bottom, a system of reality which compels them to, for example, in the case of the French exile from Algeria, to defend French reasons for having ruled Algeria. The Mississippi or the Alabama sheriff, who really does believe when he's facing a Negro boy or girl, that this woman, this man, this child, must be insane to attack the system to which he owes his entire identity. Of course, for such a person, the proposition of which we're trying to discuss here tonight does not exist. And on the other hand, I have to speak as one of the people who've been most attacked by what we must now here call the Western or the European system of reality. What white people in the world, the white box of white supremacy, I hate to say it here, comes from Europe. That's how it got to America. Beneath them, whatever one's reaction to this proposition is, has to be the question of whether or not civilizations can be considered as such equal, or whether one civilization has the right to overtake
and subjugate and in fact to destroy another. Now what happens when that happens? Leaving aside all the physical facts which one can quote, leaving aside rape or murder, leaving aside the bloody catalog of oppression, which we are in one way too familiar with already, what this does to the subjugated, the most private, the most serious thing this does to the subjugated, is to destroy his sense of reality. It destroys, for example, his father's authority over him. His father can no longer tell him anything because the past has disappeared, and his father has no power in the world. This means, in the case of an American Negro, born in that glittering republic, and in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white, and since you have not yet seen a mirror, you suppose that you are too. It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover the flag which you have pledged allegiance along with everybody else has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you. It comes as a great shock to discover that the country which is your birthplace and to which you owe your life and your identity has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you. The disaffection, the demoralization, and the gap between one person and another only on the basis of the color of their skin begins there and accelerates throughout a whole lifetime so that presently someone else is with for nothing. For nothing. The Southern oligarchy, which has until today so much power in Washington, and therefore some power in the world, was created by my labor and my sweat, and the violation of my women, and the murder of my children. This, in the land of the free, and the home of the brave, and no one and challenge that statement. It is a matter of historical record. In another way, this dream, and we'll get to the dream in a moment, is at the expense of the American Negro. You watch this in the Deep South in great relief, but not only in the Deep South. In the Deep South, you are dealing with a sheriff or a landlord or a landlady or the girl at the Western Union desk. And she doesn't know quite who she's dealing with, by which I mean that if you're not part of the town, and if you are a northern nigger, it shows in millions of ways. So she simply knows that it's an unknown quantity and she wants to have nothing to do with it. Corpses of my ancestors. Why is my freedom or my citizenship or my right to live there? How is it concealed their question now? And I suggest further that in the same way, the moral life of Alabama sheriffs and poor Alabama ladies, white ladies, their moral lives have been destroyed by the plague called color. That the American sense of reality has been corrupted by it. At the risk of sounding excessive, what I always felt when I finally left the country, found myself abroad in other places, and watched Americans abroad. And these are my countrymen. And I do care about them. And even if I didn't, there is something between us. We have the same shorthand. I know. When I look at a girl or a boy from Tennessee, where they came from in Tennessee, and what that means. No Englishman knows that, no Frenchman, no one in the world knows that except another black man who comes from the same place. One watches these lonely people denying the only kin they have. We talk about integration in America as though it was some great new conundrum. The problem in America is that we've been integrated for a very long time. Put me next to any African, and you will see what I mean. And my grandmother was not a racist. What we are not facing is the results of what we've done. What one begs the American people to do for all our sake is simply to accept our history. I was there not only as a slave, but also as a concubine. One knows the power, after all, which can be used against another person if you've got absolute power over that person. It seemed to me when I watched Americans in Europe that what they didn't know about Europeans was what they didn't know about me. They weren't trying, for example, to be nasty to the French girl or rude to the French waiter. They didn't know they hurt their feelings. They didn't have any sense that this particular woman, this particular man, though they spoke another language and had different manners and ways, was a human being. And they walked over them with the same kind of bland ignorance, condescension, charming, cheerful, with which they'd always patted me on the head and called me shy, and were upset when I was upset. What is relevant about this is that whereas 40 years ago when I was born, the question of having to deal with what is unspoken by the subjugated, what is never said to the master, rather having to deal with this reality, it was a very remote possibility. It was in no one's mind. When I was growing up, I was taught in American history books but Africa had no history, and neither did I. That I was a savage, about whom the less said the better, who had been saved by Europe and brought to America. And of course, I believed it. I didn't have much choice. Those were the only books there were. Everyone else seemed to agree. If you walk out of Harlem, ride out of Harlem, downtown, the world agrees what you see is much bigger, cleaner, whiter, richer, safer than where you are. They collect the garbage. People obviously can pay their life insurance. The children look happy, safe. You're not. And you go back home. And it would seem then, of course, that it's an act of God, that this is true. That you belong where white people have put you. Best is that that is what concerns me most. We are sitting in this room and we are all, at least we like to think we are, relatively civilized. And we can talk to each other at least on certain levels. So that we could walk out of here assuming that the measure of our enlightenment or at least our politeness has some effect on the world. It may not. I remember, for example, when the ex-Attorney General, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America, we might have a Negro president. And that sounded like a very emancipated statement, I suppose, to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard, and did not hear, and possibly will never hear, the laughter and the bitterness and the scorn with which the statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday. And now he's already on his way to the presidency. We've been here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you're good, we may let you become president. What is dangerous here is the turning away from anything any white American says. The reason for the political hesitation in spite of the Johnson landslide is that one has been betrayed by American politicians for so long. And I'm a grown man, and perhaps I can be reasoned with. I certainly hope I can be. But I don't know. And neither does Martin Luther King. None of us know how to deal with those other people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't entirely believe anything I or Martin say. And one can't blame them. You watch what has happened to them in less than 20 years. It would not be, it says, urban renewal, that Negroes simply are going to be thrown out into the streets, which is what it does mean now. This is not an act of God. We're dealing with a society made and ruled by men. If the American Negro had not been president in America, I am convinced that the history of the American labor movement would be much more edifying than it is. It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America. I am not an object of missionary charity. I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream, because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, will wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
Break your heart. A whole generation of young people who believed in things went looking for a neat little pill to cure what was wrong with society. They didn't find it because there isn't any pill like that. They got their hearts busted instead. Those people were our parents. Our generation has no ideology. We don't believe in pills. There are no pat little answers. Not capitalism, not socialism, not communism. What we are fumbling our way towards is a kind of moral ideology, a new radicalism. You don't need any ideology to say that the society stinks. You don't need any complex thinking to say that discrimination is wrong. You know, just plain wrong without any ifs, ands, or buts, and it's got to stop. All you need to know is that certain things are wrong and that they have to be stopped. We've learned another lesson too. If you want to see things made better, then baby, there's only one guy you can count on to do anything about it, and that's you. No adults will do it. Can't lend a hand, man. Stand back. Don't bug us. Let us get on with the job. Something's been happening for 7 years now. Thank you.
1,000 of us sat in, and we wouldn't leave. We were sitting because they wanted to take away our tables. We were sitting because we wanted the right to use the campus as we had been using it, to organize protest demonstrations off campus. And we were sitting because we wanted the university to treat us like human beings. So we got busted. Called in the cops. They arrested 800 of us. So we pulled a strike. We pulled the largest strike ever to hit an American university. 16,000 kids went out.
You have. To destroying this university, you've not won anything.
But she wants us to be martyrs. We don't want to be martyrs.
I think you're safe. I don't think we're really prepared to put up anything. There are good laws in the Constitution,
and there are bad laws. You set yourself up as the arbiter of the law, and I say you're no arbiter.
The university has abdicated its responsibility as a cultural integrator.
What's the difference? Where you? Look, the difference is you're going to stay for years. The difference is while I'm here, I care.
My whole life.
Commitment.
Now, the difference is this is my whole life. A. B.
My whole life is present.
My whole life is the past, the present, and the future.
You are doing a job which is part of a bigger system.
It's the proverbial
they. It's the proverbial they.
The university is not. I'm talking about the university. The machine. They do not feel guilt even now. What they felt was, we made a terrible mistake. They're running the machine. The machine is still right. The machine is still right. The IBM is still functioning.
They're still shuffling us through as a bunch of cards. The machine was still right. The machine is still right. They feel we somehow missed in the error of human judgment.
There's another wild thing in that mass education is like if the average Joe in the street really knew what he's paying for,
he'd go out of his mind. You know, they actually give the United States Constitution to kids to read. These idiots in San Diego who are preparing for a red Chinese invasion across the Mexican border ever read the Declaration of Independence and realized that their kids were reading that and really reading it. It's just unbelievable. These kids are going to take this stuff seriously, you know? And they're you know, the fact that they're taking it seriously, and then, you know, that 700 people sit in a straw hall, and then everybody's amazed.
And then they're going to talk.
What's wrong with mass education? You know, what's right with mass education? People are taking these things seriously.
This is the way it's working.
I certainly am a product of the school. Whatever way I turned out, I still am a product. You know, mass education, you have to react to. In one way or another. And the funny thing about it is it forces you to either become addicted to it and to become or it turns you off and it turns your stomach and you want to annihilate it and you have all these crazy feelings that, and you get mixed up and neurotic and you get in your classroom and you start twitching and you get bored and you leave and you go to seek something else.
If some...
I've eaten paperbacks. I've eaten hardbacks. I've eaten lectures. I've eaten words. You know, when I came here, and learning was going to be a great thing for me, my mind was really opened, and it wasn't taught. I learned. But I learned in spite of the university. I got the great bureaucratic education. I learned by beating the system. I don't know who to blame. I can't blame any one person. It's not some kind of devil force or conspiracy that's depriving me of an education. It's, again, the machine.
Have little or no control over the prices of its products.
I think size has a lot to do with it. They have classes with 1,200 and 1,400 kids in huge auditoriums, body after body, just sitting there. In the TV classes, and neither one can communicate. It's really like looking at one another through a screen, or it's like one movie being brought to see another movie. and vice versa. And having to go through this is a horrifying and personal experience. Where you start asking yourself, why should I sit in class? And so that's where Phi-Bates come in. Phi-Bates is a store. It's a house of intellectual prostitution. It's a store where they hire good students to go to bad lectures, to take notes, and these notes are then printed up and sold.
Pretty good, huh? Back on 40.
What's the Ed Pepperman course?
Like anything else, I feel about teaching it and about learning it, just as I feel about all the other things in my life and about being a person. It's like when I read a poem that turns me on, I want to take it around to everyone I know and say, you know, look, wow, what a good poem this is. And teaching math is the same thing.
Or even F.
You really have to believe in it. You say, you know, gee, isn't this beautiful?
Oh,
and if you're lucky, you can get it across. It makes a link between you and other people. If you're very fortunate,
you can, see him, huh?
You can give them maybe something of what you feel in it.
It's a uniform boundedness condition, essentially.
Beautiful guy.
It says, if linear functional is nice, you know, i.e. continuous, then it doesn't take a vector into here. If
one hassle is that you have to contend with a lot of kids who are there only because their parents want them to be there.
And the vector,
you know, they're there to get a passport to a job, or they're there to learn how to make fancy fenders for cars, or to make missiles.
It is lonely. It isn't personal. It is cold.
Yes, Miss Coleman.
The incarnation is the negation. The pity of it all is, this university could be so great. Well, I mean, actually, it sometimes is. I mean, to give an example, Professor Karl Shorsky lecturing on Hegel.
I don't mean that. It's just that,
he is alive. He's broken out of the screen. He talks to students. Not many of them do.
That pure spirit has become matter, has become flesh. If you like putting it very radically, if you put it very radically, you can say God is a narcissist. God is, now this is not quite so silly. God fulfills himself at one level, and perhaps all lovers are narcissists. Don't read this off too short. That you find fulfillment in the other, who is in some sense your mirror, is perhaps not so absurd as it may sound. In any case, God is at least an offbeat narcissist, in the sense that he creates a world which is in his image.
Actually, it can be very exciting. You are observing and watching and listening, but at the same time, you are thinking. You are watching that man think, and suddenly, something is cutting through. You are not only watching him work out a problem, you are working it out too. You're learning how to think. I mean, hell, that's invaluable. The trouble is, it gets knocked out of them. I'll be graduating very soon. I'm going to have to go out into the world, and I'm really glad to get out. I've been here for a long time, and I don't want to stay in Berkeley and not grow up and not face the world. It's kind of scary, too, because I've gone to school all my life. School is really the only thing that I know. It's a whole way of thinking. It's not that I've really grown up so much at school. Maturity has come from my personal life, not from school. But it is true that school opened my mind to certain things, to certain books, to certain ideas, to certain ways of thinking that I would not have come by on my own. Looking back, I really would like to see a real community developed at Cal. It could be a fantastic thing. Not the machine, but something very personal, something very harmonious for every person involved. And in that community, and in the building of the community, I think that the students can really help. We can help. Because we really have something to contribute, if only they'd listen.
The young activist.
And I don't think that we ought to be signing petitions, for example.
Process. You do not come here to be educated, to have facts driven into you.
What Parker means when he talks about responsible free speech.
Last semester here, we shook up the whole system. We took the responsibility for seeing that the right thing happened, and it did. And it cost us 800 kids in jail. But by God, the right thing did happen. The Plaza is a 17-ring circus now.
Important that students be given voice and vote.
You appeal to the conscience of decent men.
At their tables now, students are free to advocate any cause they wish, and they do. The causes range the entire spectrum of political belief. The advocacy of radical causes by some students led, not surprisingly, to the charge that they are tinged with communist influence. FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover has testified that while the Berkeley demonstrations were not communist-originated or controlled, they were exploited by a handful of communists among the students for their own ends. A respected research report written by graduate students in political science at the university found the following. Of the 800 who were arrested and who answered the questionnaire, 57% belonged to no political group. Only 4.5% belonged to radical groups. 1.2% belonged to conservative groups. Academically, the activists are among the best students in the university.
Decisions which affect their lives.
College students tend to be romantic and to fall in love. They tend also to approach sex with rapturous wonder, as though they had invented it themselves for the benefit of humanity. This has always been true, and it has always had a kind of beauty. What is new is that a sexual revolution is sweeping across campuses today as young people like Ron Anastasi and Sally Leary seek greater freedom. And this, in the finest tradition of rebellion, has somehow all become involved with politics, as though some fateful equation existed between sexual freedom, free speech, and a rejection of the values of an adult generation.
I think that many adults, many people, in fact, today, because not all of our generation feel the way we do, have a kind of unfortunate attitude toward sex that it's a privilege that is sort of granted to you after you've signed a kind of contract, and they've forgotten what I consider the most important thing about sex, and that it is the most intense expression of love that one human being can show for another, you know?
Yeah.
And that love is in no sense conditional upon signing any kind of legal contract.
I mean, you know, most of the attitudes that our parents have come from.
Thank you. morals, because, you know, I'm going to make every effort to see that my kids grow up free from the kind of fears and guilt and dirtinesses that I did grow up
in. I think how great the communication's going to be between us and our kids because of it.
The chat.
Well, all right, there will be more communication.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there's still basic things. I mean, yeah. Like I was trying to say before, maybe there isn't that hang up, but after all, how many of us, I mean, there is a lot of being indiscriminate and being promiscuous in Berkeley, and real, terrible unhappiness.
There's a lot of unhappiness everywhere,
baby. Right.
You are.
But even...
The Berkeley rebels live a way of life indelibly their own. They refuse to label it, and indeed, no one label seems quite right. Not beat,